We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
What's your name, son?
Danny Bernstein. I'm from Deerfield, Illinois.
Dan Bernstein on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
That's enough. Don't care. Not interested.
Insightful sports talk for your workday from one of Chicago's most respected radio professionals.
Professional what?
Professional penis.
You don't know what the hell you're doing!
Dan Bernstein.
The guy is full of hot air.
In a semi-permanent state of flatulence.
Middays on The Score.
We're broadcasting live from the Hyundai Score Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. And man, we are busy today. Coming up at 9:20, we are going to talk to Chicago-based Fangraphs writer Craig Edwards, who's been doing some of the math on what's really going on in the baseball books right here. And we'll talk to him about some of these continuing unfortunate comments being made by Tom Ricketts, who really has been the only owner that is out there in the middle of all of this still crying poor. We've got football talk coming at 10 with Mike Florio, because it's Wednesday. We do that at 10 o'clock with him. Pro Football Talk, NBC Sports at 10. Midday Midway at 10:40. 11 o'clock, Keith Smith from Yahoo Sports, who is really plugged in to the NBA's return plan because he's a former Disney employee and has services within that corporation. And it does appear that they're finalizing some of the plans to bring the NBA back. Thankfully, it appears without the 2019-2020 Chicago Bulls, because sports are better without the 2019-2020 Chicago Bulls. Dave Hyde, longtime South Florida Sun Sentinel columnist, wrote something about our current situation in sports and the dearth of black coaches, especially in the NFL, and why that's meaningful. It is context for all the discussions that we've had regarding the NFL's efforts to better integrate their ranks and how what is the right way to do it beyond what has been tried in the past, and why, especially in times like these, why it's important, why it matters. He really put his finger on that, so he's going to join us at 11:20. And then at 11:40, we're going to continue our conversations we've been having with play-by-play folks from here in Chicago. Len Casper, the voice of the Cubs on the Marquee Network, is going to join us at 11:40. Surprises always along the way as well. 312-644-6767. That's the number at WSCR The Score. You can email us at Bernstein@670thescore.com. You go there to listen to us live because we stream at 670thescore.com. You want to send a text? Text the text zone that is brought to you by Rosen Hyundai of Algonquin. Save time. Shop online at rosenhyundai.com. You can reach the text zone via the same number that you call. 312-644-6767. That short code you used to use doesn't work anymore. So it's that very same number. We keep it easy. You send a text, we reply. Message and data rates may apply. Twitter is at Bernstein670. My personal account is at Dan_Bernstein. You must download the radio.com app. You have to do that. It's a great app. You can pause and rewind, DVR-like controls, crystal clear, listening in the car, however you want to do it. You can interact with the show and the station on Facebook as well by liking the 670 The Score page. Jay Zawoski is our executive producer. Ray Diaz, the executioner, is the man on the board doing the things that he does. I can't figure out, other than just pure tone deafness, first of all, what's going on in the Ricketts family in general? Because Pete Ricketts just can't stop stepping in it. And now Tom is forced to answer questions about his brother, who, by the way, is no longer even a nominal member of the ownership group. He was initially. He was among the Ricketts scions who had his name in the ownership group, and now has, I don't know if he sold it to his siblings or if he's silent partner, however that works. But now the governor of Nebraska is not technically even a nominal Cubs owner, but Tom Ricketts is. And he figured that yesterday was a good time to continue this media tour. And he's been out there. He's been the owner that has been out there more than any other baseball owner to say, we don't have any money and we're all out of money and there's no money. And boy, we're just, everything we do it for everybody else. And we put all the money back in the park. But right now, at this time, this is, I don't know what there is to gain here. But he's continuing to treat fans and treat us like we're dumb. Like we don't see what's happening. And there are a couple different baseball models here. There's a couple of MLB models. And obviously there are some baseball teams in smaller markets that are run as a grift, that they get their share of revenue sharing from the richer teams. They cash in on baseball advanced media, and they cash in on some television deals, and they don't pay the players. That's one way to do baseball business. And it's gross, and it's a violation of any public trust and the assumption that a team is trying to win. And there are teams that do that. The Cubs are not. However, on the other end of the spectrum are teams that have the opportunity to increase their value, increase their worth. And I understand that it's not cash flow, that the value of the team, the equity of the team is not the same as the cash flow. But look at what the Cubs have been doing. When Tom Ricketts tells ESPN's Jesse Rogers about how much they're putting back in the park, how much they're spending in the park, they're not doing that as a favor to us. They're not doing that as look, this is just what we want to do for you. Look at what we're doing to fix up the park. When they say fix up the park, there was a time when that park needed to be fixed up. You remember that time? That's when blocks of concrete were literally falling on people's heads because the park was falling apart. Actual chunks of concrete were falling down, and they put nets in there. This is I covered those teams, and I went and I looked at the nets, and I did stories on what they were doing to actually keep concrete blocks from breaking off and falling on people's heads. That's fixing up the park. When he says we're putting money into the park now, that's not what he means. He means they're finding ways to make more money from the park. When an area that used to be accessible to everyone is now only accessible to people who pay a fee to join a club. When areas of the park that used to be accessible to everyone are now for corporations to hold their parties or for them to use for political fundraisers, for ways to maximize the revenue generation of the park, even in the off season, with restaurants and clubs and meeting rooms and areas. That's not fixing up the park. That's monetizing the park. And that's even if we just talk about the ballpark. Because when he says the ballpark, he doesn't mean just Wrigley Field. He means all the other areas that his capital firm and his real estate firm owns. That's not fixing up the ballpark. That's finding ways to make money off of everything around it. And then he used the term, people are making a lot of, saying the losses are biblical. And say what you want about that. And I mean, that doesn't necessarily, I know he doesn't mean literally biblical. He means it's what, giant, just the enormity of everything. It's an intensifier that he used. And I understand that. But it's just, why now? Why right now with everything that's happening and everybody focused on very, very real things and very, very real pain? People are actually in the streets right outside Wrigley Field, marching right past that marquee, people demanding to be heard, demanding to be listened to. And instead it's a billionaire picking up a phone to cry about reduced revenue. Really? Is that, and it's only anecdotal, and there are, I don't know how Cub fans feel. I don't know when people care. And I know that there's always going to be hypocrisy in the teams for whom we root. You can always find a reason to say, yeah, I probably shouldn't like this as much as I do. But at some point, people just have to think, come on, you know, what am I doing here? To what am I contributing? And as long as you are able to have the bandwidth to handle all that stuff and to handle our own hypocrisy and say, yeah, you know, I kind of not real happy with Joe Ricketts's emails. I'm not real happy with Pete Ricketts apparently being a racist and as the governor of Nebraska. And by the way, we should mention too, that the stuff that's going on with Pete Ricketts to calling the black leaders of Omaha, you people, and the problem I have with you people. And look, call that what that is. That's flat racist, flatly, plainly, overtly, right in our faces. Pete Ricketts is the same guy that ripped Nebraska linebacker Michael Rose Ivy in 2016. Remember that. Linebacker Michael Rose Ivy of the Nebraska Cornhuskers kneeled during the national anthem before the game here at Northwestern. And Pete Ricketts went on the radio and called him disgraceful and disrespectful. Remember that. Called him disgraceful and disrespectful because he was protesting the murders of unarmed black men at the hands of white police officers. He called him disgraceful and disrespectful. And it's all just baked into the whole thing. And I don't want to conflate the fact that, Pete Ricketts is not currently an owner of the Cubs. But then Tom Ricketts in the paper today says, well, he's not racist. Yeah, he kind of is. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that. We know. We've got the emails. We get his statements. Multiply. We've got all this stuff. So I just that you're picking up a sports section or you're clicking on something because you want to read about the Cubs and you end up having to deal with this cognitive dissonance all the time. And crying poor right now? How many millions of people are out of work? I mean, right now we've got independent shopkeepers who are cleaning up and people trying to make some sense of their business. And, you know, restaurant owners in general, as everything reopens, hoping that they can cobble a life together. And everybody across the board, everyone at every level, there's furloughs and pay cuts, and the Chicago Cubs are saying, look, we didn't really run at a profit. We put everything back in the park. You put it back in the park to make more money. You put it back in the park because you're buying up all the land around the park and financing all this. You're borrowing money to finance these purchases. And it's not dumb. It's really good business. You start your own television network because it's generally good business. And we make 70% of our revenue from game day. Yeah, I don't think so. If you actually look at the numbers and you talk to people who have done the math on that, that's probably kind of not true. And he says, people think that we're hoarding money. No, we're not dumb. We don't think you're hoarding money. We know you've made a ton of money, hand over fist. And yeah, players get paid handsomely. But this was just, you don't want to wake up to this. You know, this comes out and you see it and we're in this wash of headlines and information and everything that's going on. And we are trying to be conscious and present in these times. And I'm just thinking like this is what you want to do right now. Maybe wait a little bit. Maybe not exactly at the moment. Maybe get baseball back. And maybe there's a little bit of goodwill when baseball comes back and just kind of let it happen. Instead of complaining, oh, this is, you know, biblical losses and this is people think we have all this money. You know why? Because you do. Because you do. And they're saying, well, we put it back in the park. We fixed up the park. You fixed up the park so you could find more ways to make money. That's why. You didn't fix up the park as some sort of altruism. Oh, it's just a park. It's a park where people can come play. We put a new swing set in the park. No, you put places to siphon people's money away. Increasing the quality of the food. That's great. Increasing the profits that you make off that food. Interesting how that works. Fixing up the park. Yes. So in December, you can get fat cat political donors to be able to rent out part of your park to make more money. It's capitalism, and I get that. But don't pretend it's not. Just be honest about it. About saying, you know, players, well, you know, we need to socialize these losses here. They need to be partners of ours. No, well, they weren't partners when you were making money hand over fist. They weren't partners then. Someone who's actually done some of the math on this is someone who does it for a living. Craig Edwards of FanGraphs has what is truth, what is fiction regarding some of these revenue numbers. And we'll get into how biblical it may be. He's been really solid, Chicago-based FanGraphs writer who's been strong trying to give us the truth about the Cubs and finances and all of that. We're going to talk to him next. I'm Dan Bernstein. You have The Score.
A message to all Score listeners out there. We know a lot of you are working from home. We're with you because a lot of us are working from home too.
Tom Thayer is joining us.
I'm in my nephew's garage, which I refer to as Studio A.
I'm in my downstairs closet. This is the closest spot to the Wi-Fi.
I listen to you guys every day, and it kind of gives you that release from all the negativity if you only sat there and watched the news 24 hours a day.
You're at home, we're at home, but we're all still connected with a love for Chicago sports on Sports Radio 670 The Score, our radio.com sports station.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago sports station.
That is the discussion. I mean, ultimately, the league as a whole is looking at about $4 billion of losses, and that's particularly hard on like teams like the Cubs. As you say, we do get 70% of our revenue from tickets, parking, concessions, game day activities, and only about 30% of our revenue from media. And that's only and only part of that is national media, so like the local television that we do. Now, we've already lost half that season. So in a best-case scenario, you know, we're looking at, you know, recovering maybe 20% of our total income. So that is where the rub is, and that's where the discussions roll.
Loves throwing around that 70% number, 70%, 70%, trying to inject that into the bloodstream. That was Tom Ricketts on CNBC. And it was just yesterday that he decides to answer the phone. And with everything else that's going on, with people actually marching in front of Wrigley Field, right down Clark Street, marching with their fists in the air for equality and justice, that he figured, well, this is a really good time for me to tell everyone how poor we are. It's a interesting decision, to say the least. I'm Dan Bernstein, and we are joined now by Craig Edwards of Fangraphs. He is on Twitter at Craig J. Edwards. He's on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. And this tweet gave me a mordant chuckle when I saw it. It was a retweet of Jeff Passan, who quoted Ricketts from the ESPN piece, "The scale of the losses across the league is biblical." And our guest wrote, "Who can forget the time Noah leveraged the building of the ark instead of spending cash he had on hand so he could later claim he wasn't making a profit?" I'd laugh if I wasn't too busy rolling my eyes audibly. Craig, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
So what's real and what's not? I want to figure some of this stuff out because I'm not a great financial mind, and I do know that when somebody who has been making as much money as the Cubs ownership has over the past couple of years off of this massive business is now saying, well, now we're out of money, we're bleeding money, and we got to take out loans and all this. Like, what's real and what's not? What's true?
Well, you know, it's not just, you know, the Cubs, but everybody, you know, on that side of the line is bending over backwards and saying, you know, throwing out percentages and numbers, but they're doing everything they can to not tell you, you know, the actual numbers. They're not going to open up their books because they don't want to, they don't have to. But, you know, if you work back from those numbers and you say, well, if 70% is local here and you know, from stadium revenue, that means that 30% is that those media rights. And you know, a rough estimation of the media rights between local and national from last year before the marquee deal is $170 million. And so that means that the 70% might be like $570 million. And you know, it sounds bad to lose that money, but it's also $100 million more than Forbes estimated that they were making when they were making a $70 million profit last year. And so the math just doesn't quite work out in his favor. The 70% figure seems like a lot, but then, you know, every time you do that, you're increasing the amount of money that you're actually claiming that the team has been making over the years.
They won't open their books because they don't want the other side of the negotiating table to actually see what's in them, or maybe the rest of us, come to think of it. What's in there specifically that would be most damning? And I know we're guessing at it, but obviously there's a reason why they won't tell us where the actual money is.
Yeah, I think that it's not what's in there, but what's not in there. It's what they're not including, you know. The Ricketts, and they own a lot of, you know, property around Wrigley Field. They're not going to include that in what they're making in baseball revenue. They just signed a new deal, you know, for TV, and obviously that's not going as well as they hoped it would without Comcast. But they're not going to include how much money they're making from that ownership stake. And, you know, for teams like the Mets and Yankees and, you know, the Dodgers deal hasn't worked out quite as well. But, you know, you're talking about $50, $100, $150 million that's sort of off the books. And, you know, I think that what they're really, you know, they don't want you to know exactly how much money they're making, but Forbes does a fairly decent job estimating things. And I think that one thing you can look at is the Atlanta Braves, because they're a publicly traded company. They have to tell you how much money they made. And over the last 2 years, they made about $150 million in profits. And the MLB is is trying to say that they never make more than $250 million a year. And that doesn't square up. You can't say that the Braves made $150 million over the last 2 years and MLB as a total made $400 million. So the Braves are an average team in an average market with an average TV deal and average attendance. You know, they're more the norm than something outside of the scope. So the numbers that they're providing publicly don't square with everything that the owners are trying to tell the players right now.
Talking with Craig Edwards of Fangraphs, Chicago-based Fangraphs writer here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. And I understand that there are baseball teams that are essentially run as a grift, where you can have a smaller market team that's like, look, we are going to just tear out payroll completely and get our revenue share chunk and get our baseball advanced media chunk and make a huge profit and not really try to win. And this was part of it was disguised as tanking, and part of it was just sort of then extending that, moving the goalposts on it. And obviously the Cubs are not that. But on a different scale, like you say, they have found a way to make the baseball business just a piece of the overall empire within the brand. But there are teams who are more openly kind of grifting the operation. True?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the Pirates.
Maybe, kind of, yeah.
But yeah, there's teams that that aren't doing as much as they could, and I think that you see teams out there who, you know, they get that $100 million from central revenue, and maybe they get you know, anywhere from, you know, $40 to $60 million from the local TV deal, and you know, they're not putting that back into the team. And it's hard to argue when you're succeeding and you're doing well on the field, and that's certainly been the case for the Cubs over the last half decade. And you know, I think that, you know, as the problem sort of with the Cubs is that they set the expectations high, and then they talked about how this TV deal was coming, it was coming, and they were gonna, you know, just go above and beyond even what they were doing before. And then the TV deal came and they're like, well, we need to wait a year. And now all of a sudden things are considerably worse than just the TV deal. And when, you know, you're not providing baseball and it seems like it's so close to happening, it just invites increased criticism.
I also think it's fair to look at the Cubs as an entertainment property that doubled down on population density as part of their business model. If it's going to be about restaurants, rooftops, gatherings, they're more exposed perhaps to social distancing losses and shutdown losses than other teams are because of how much revenue they do. The hotel, I mean, and all of it, all of these areas, they're more an entertainment brand than just a baseball team right now. Does that mean that they would then going forward, but with all the unknowns, be in danger of increased headwinds?
You know, it's possible, and you know, we know that the Cubs have significant salary commitments coming up in the next few years, and they've got, you know, Chris Bryant and Javi Baez and Kyle Schwarber all headed towards free agency, and you don't know if they kind of cut back a little bit. You know, this isn't the same as the Mets and Bernie Madoff, but when the Mets owners had personal problems with finances, they slashed payroll. And you know, that's something that could conceivably happen with the Cubs. I don't think it's super likely. You know, hopefully things sort of return to normal at some point, and all those investments that the Cubs have been making and investments that they made, you know, with the expectation that they would bring in even more revenue, that they pay off. And you know, because people are excited about the Cubs and head down to Wrigley and go to the hotel and restaurants, et cetera.
I've been heartened to see the number of casual baseball fans who are actually better understanding the players' side in the labor negotiation. It's been a theme of what's been going on here, where in years past and other work stoppages of various kinds that I've covered for a quarter century, it's always been greedy players, greedy players, greedy players, and it was very easy to demonize the players. It's not happening right now. And where maybe teams, and the Cubs included, have counted on villainizing Scott Boras and having him as this sort of negative connotation that he's the guy that gets the money for the greedy players, Boras has been really putting it out there. And when he explains, this is what the Cubs have been doing for debt financing, and this is how they're increasing the value of their assets by taking this money and buying these things and borrowing money to buy these things, and people are listening. I wonder why do you think it is that people are more aware now of how of what is happening in this negotiation and why it's been more difficult to make players seem like the bad guys?
Well, you know, over the last decade, we've seen teams hand out a lot fewer really bad contracts. So, you know, they're victims of their own success in that sort of way. You know, we've seen, you know, billions of dollars being pumped into baseball over the last few years while salaries have stayed the same. And I think people are paying a lot more attention to salaries than they were before. They're paying more attention to prospects, and that's good for the sport overall that people are interested in every single aspect. But when you become more interested in every single aspect, you know, you see, hey, that's TV deal and that new contract with, you know, Fox or whoever. And you wonder, you know, why can't they just, you know, do something for 1 year to make sure that we have baseball right now when you've been making all this money over the past few years? And, you know, I don't know that it's completely shifted. I think that the owners have been, you know, still somewhat successful in waging sort of their PR battle, and the players aren't ever going to win one. But when you have guys like Max Scherzer, who I don't think anybody questions his love of the game, his commitment for it, and just how big of a competitor he is, you know, when he's saying, hey, you know, what they've shown us just doesn't cut it. And, you know, we're out there. We want to compete. We want to win. And I think more fans are listening to that type of argument.
Where are you on the optimism-pessimism continuum when it comes to following this particular negotiation and seeing the barbs that get traded back and forth between Rob Manfred and Tony Clark, which sometimes are just sort of the spasms of a proper labor negotiation? That's just how these things go. Other people say, well, it's bad blood and there's no trust. And I don't know, I'm among those who think that there's an inevitability of the restoration of some kind of season. Where are you?
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic. I think that the players made a good step forward, and you know, it seemed like the owners were about to counteroffer with a 50-game season, and then you know, you negotiate from there. I think that that is potentially, you know, a big deal, but the owners actually haven't countered with that, and that's the next step that we need to see. But you know, if the players are saying 114, the owners are saying 50. You know, you meet in the middle somewhere, you'd add an extra round of the playoffs, maybe you defer a few more salaries, and all of a sudden, you know, all of the issues that made things seem so glum, you know, a week ago sort of disappear and evaporate. But we need to see things pick up the pace a little bit and see both sides going back and forth. You know, the last time the owners floated a deal and didn't make an offer, it took them 2 weeks, and we just don't have that kind of time right now.
One thing I love about FanGraphs is when really smart people start looking at data or thinking about how they look at data, there's this there's a philosophy of what aren't we seeing, what can we anticipate, what don't we know. When it comes to this season, if we assume there is going to be a season, Is there anything in general that you have been thinking about, that people within the metric community have been thinking about how numbers are going to be different, how they're going to be understood, or what signals you can find in there that are meaningful now?
You know, I think that, you know, if we end up having roughly half a season, you know, it's going to be a lot easier for everybody to understand, you know, exactly what the stats are, because everything's just cut in half. But I think the biggest thing that everybody needs to understand is just how much more variability there is when it comes to a player's stats, when it comes to especially in the standings. I know that Dan Zimborski just did a projection yesterday over a 50-game season. In the NL Central, he had the Cubs winning 27-23 with a three-way tie for second at 26-24. And that sort of tells you that over the course of 2 months, basically anything can happen. And if you can't find your closer for the first month of the season, well, that's nearly half the season, you know, and three or four blown games are going to be the difference between making the playoffs and not making the playoffs. And there's going to be some teams that over the course of a 162-game season would have, you know, sort of gotten everything figured out and made it to the top by the end of the season. But if it's only 50 games, maybe even if it's only 80 games, there's going to be some teams that are really good on paper who might not make the playoffs, and there's going to be some teams who might surprise. I mean, if you look at the standings after 60 or 70 games last year, I think the Rangers were in playoff position, and by the end of the season, they had fallen back just like everybody expected they would. But over the course of a short season, you know, almost anything can happen in terms of the standings.
Yeah, I think and people get bothered by that when you talk about variance, and I always have to give that speech when it comes time for the playoffs and say that, you know, the 162 determines the best team and the playoffs determine the winner of the World Series. And reminding people that a bad player can have a great series. A bad team can have a great 2 weeks. And then we make all sorts of false conclusions and draw all we say, well, this is good and this is bad, and we know this, we don't know this. In a short season, it's going to create a lot of wrong opinions and a lot of wrong thoughts, I think, and we're not going to know what's real in some of this stuff, but it doesn't mean it's not fun.
Yeah, exactly. And if you compare it to, say, the hockey playoffs, you know, the grind of those playoffs crowns a deserving champion. And I think in baseball, it's sort of the opposite. It's the grind of the regular season determines which teams are worthy of being potentially a champion. And then the playoffs are sort of the fun, random, you know, event of the month that crowns the champion. But we're going to have sort of a mix of that this season. But yeah, you're exactly right. It should be fun.
Appreciate it, Craig, very much, and keep up the good fight when it comes to holding some of these teams accountable to what they say about their finances.
Thank you.
Craig Edwards of FanGraphs here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. When we come back, our guy Vic Fangio, whether he intended to or not, the former Bears defensive coordinator and current head coach of the Denver Broncos, made it very, very clear what our ongoing problem is. And he exemplified exactly what people are trying to point out. And it's really important that we hear him in his own words and call this exactly what it is. And we'll do that next. I'm Dan Bernstein. You have The Score.
This is 670 The Score, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station, period. Thanks for keeping us on top, Chicago.
Ez and Kyle Schwarber all headed towards free agency, and you don't know if they kind of cut back a little bit. You know, this isn't the same as the Mets and Bernie Madoff, but when the Mets owners had personal problems with finances, they slashed payroll. And you know, that's something that could conceivably happen with the Cubs. I don't think it's super likely. You know, hopefully things sort of return to normal at some point, and all those investments that the Cubs have been making and investments that they made, you know, with the expectation that they would bring in even more revenue, that they pay off, and you know, because people are excited about the Cubs and head down to Wrigley and go to the hotel and restaurants, et cetera.
I've been heartened to see the number of casual baseball fans who are actually better understanding the players' side in the labor negotiation. It's been a theme of what's been going on here, where in years past and other work stoppages of various kinds that I've covered for a quarter century, it's always been greedy players, greedy players, greedy players, and it was very easy to demonize the players. It's not happening right now. And where maybe teams, and the Cubs included, have counted on villainizing Scott Boras and having him as this sort of negative connotation that he's the guy that gets the money for the greedy players. Boras has been really putting it out there. And when he explains, this is what the Cubs have been doing for debt financing, and this is how they're increasing the value of their assets by taking this money and buying these things and borrowing money to buy these things, and people are listening. I wonder why do you think it is that people are more aware now of what is happening in this negotiation and why it's been more difficult to make players seem like the bad guys?
Well, you know, over the last decade, we've seen teams hand out a lot fewer really bad contracts. So, you know, they're victims of their own success in that sort of way. You know, we've seen, you know, billions of dollars being pumped into baseball over the last few years while salaries have stayed the same. And I think people are paying a lot more attention to salaries than they were before. They're paying more attention to prospects, and that's good for the sport overall that people are interested in every single aspect. But when you become more interested in every single aspect, you know, you see, hey, that's TV deal and that new contract with, you know, Fox or whoever. And you wonder, you know, why can't they just, you know, do something for 1 year to make sure that we have baseball right now when you've been making all this money over the past few years? And, you know, I don't know that it's completely shifted. I think that the owners have been, you know, still somewhat successful in waging sort of their PR battle, and the players aren't ever going to win one. But, when you have guys like Max Scherzer, who I don't think anybody questions his love of the game, his commitment for it, and just how big of a competitor he is, you know, when he's saying, hey, you know, what they've shown us just doesn't cut it. And, you know, we're out there. We want to compete. We want to win. And I think more fans are listening to that type of argument.
Where are you on the optimism-pessimism continuum when it comes to following this particular negotiation and seeing the barbs that get traded back and forth between Rob Manfred and Tony Clark, which sometimes are just sort of the spasms of a proper labor negotiation? That's just how these things go. Other people say, well, it's bad blood and there's no trust. And I don't know, I'm among those who think that there's an inevitability of the restoration of some kind of season. Where are you?
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic. I think that the players made a good step forward, and you know, it seemed like the owners were about to counteroffer with a 50-game season, and then, you know, you negotiate from there. I think that that is potentially, you know, a big deal, but the owners actually haven't countered with that, and that's the next step that we need to see. But, you know, if the players are saying 114, the owners are saying 50, you know, you meet in the middle somewhere, you'd add an extra round of the playoffs, maybe you defer a few more salaries, and all of a sudden, you know, all of the issues that made things seem so glum, you know, a week ago sort of disappear and evaporate. But we need to see things pick up the pace a little bit and see both sides going back and forth. You know, the last time the owners floated a deal and didn't make an offer, it took them 2 weeks, and we just don't have that kind of time right now.
One thing I love about FanGraphs is when really smart people start looking at data or thinking about how they look at data, there's this there's a philosophy of what aren't we seeing, what can we anticipate, what don't we know. When it comes to this season, if we assume there is going to be a season, is there anything in general that you have been thinking about, that people within the metric community have been thinking about how numbers are going to be different, how they're going to be understood, or what signals you can find in there that are meaningful now?
You know, I think that, you know, if we end up having roughly half a season, you know, it's going to be a lot easier for everybody to understand, you know, exactly what the stats are, because everything's just cut in half. But I think the biggest thing that everybody needs to understand is just how much more variability there is when it comes to a player's stats, when it comes to especially in the standings. I know that Dan Zimborski just did a projection yesterday over a 50-game season. In the NL Central, he had the Cubs winning 27-23 with a three-way tie for second at 26-24. And that sort of tells you that over the course of 2 months, basically anything can happen. And if you can't find your closer for the first month of the season, well, that's nearly half the season, you know, and three or four blown games are going to be the difference between making the playoffs and not making the playoffs. And there's going to be some teams that over the course of a 162 game season would have, you know, sort of gotten everything figured out and made it to the top by the end of the season. But if it's only 50 games, maybe even if it's only 80 games, there's going to be some teams that are really good on paper who might not make the playoffs, and there's going to be some teams who might surprise. I mean, if you look at the standings after 60 or 70 games last year, I think the Rangers were in playoff position, and by the end of the season, they had fallen back just like everybody expected they would. But over the course of a short season, you know, almost anything can happen in terms of the standings.
Yeah, I think and people get bothered by that when you talk about variance, and I always have to give that speech when it comes time for the playoffs and say that, you know, the 162 determines the best team and the playoffs determine the winner of the World Series. And reminding people that a bad player can have a great series. A bad team can have a great 2 weeks. And then we make all sorts of false conclusions and draw all we say, well, this is good and this is bad, and we know this, we don't know this. In a short season, it's going to create a lot of wrong opinions and a lot of wrong thoughts, I think, and we're not going to know what's real in some of this stuff, but it doesn't mean it's not fun.
Yeah, exactly. And if you compare it to, say, the hockey playoffs, you know, the grind of those playoffs crowns a deserving champion. And I think in baseball, it's sort of the opposite. It's the grind of the regular season determines which teams are worthy of being potentially a champion. And then the playoffs are sort of the fun, random, you know, event of the month that crowns the champion. But we're going to have sort of a mix of that this season. But yeah, you're exactly right. It should be fun.
Appreciate it, Craig, very much, and keep up the good fight when it comes to holding some of these teams accountable to what they say about their finances.
Thank you.
Craig Edwards of FanGraphs here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. When we come back, our guy Vic Fangio, whether he intended to or not, the former Bears defensive coordinator and current head coach of the Denver Broncos, made it very, very clear what our ongoing problem is. And he exemplified exactly what people are trying to point out. And it's really important that we hear him in his own words and call this exactly what it is. And we'll do that next. I'm Dan Bernstein. You have The Score.
This is 670 The Score, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station, period. Thanks for keeping us on top, Chicago. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
We have to figure out what we can do, not only as a team, but as a organization. How can we get out and how can we impact the Denver community? You know, how can we... Maybe we can get out and put together a march as a team or something like that. I feel like we have to get out in the community and be heard.
That's Broncos safety Kareem Jackson. And that's a noble sentiment. I think it's great. I also think that, Kareem, you might want to talk to your coach. That's all I'll say before we hear what Vic Fangio had to say about what's going on, because he met with reporters. And just listen carefully to some of this stuff and understand where the problem lies in how some of this is discussed and what people think they know about and what they think they are seeing and perceiving as opposed to what is actually out there. Dan Bernstein with you, Sports Radio 670 The Score. I'm on 9 a.m. to noon, Monday through Friday, and we're going to talk football with Mike Florio coming up at 10. We got a really busy final hour, too, with Keith Smith with the latest on the NBA. Dave Hyde of the South Florida Sun Sentinel with some terrific stuff as well. And Casper's going to jump in. We got a lot to do. Also, midway at 10:40. But this is Broncos head coach Vic Fangio in a Zoom conference with Denver media. And he started out with a prepared statement regarding the murder of George Floyd.
Usually I just start fielding questions, as you guys know, and girls. I just wanted to share with you some thoughts I've had from the past few days before we get started. I was shocked, sad, and angry when I saw the policeman due to a handcuffed George Floyd on his stomach that led to his death. He should be punished to the fullest extent of the law for the crimes he has been charged with, in addition to being charged with treason for failing to uphold the badge and the uniform he was entrusted with. I have the utmost respect and admiration for the police and the job they do under trying circumstances. They allow us to have a great country on a daily basis. The Minnesota cop failed the 99% of the police that do a great job, and we are all paying a price for that. I've listened to many people talk the past few days, and the one that resonated with me the most was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He also recognized that 98 to 99% of the police do a tremendous job in tough situations, and we must do all we can to correct the small percentage that don't do a great job on a daily basis. Kareem was one person talking sensibly and with solutions. This is not a political issue. We have had similar situations in St. Louis in 2014, Baltimore in 2015, and others recently and prior to those. It's a societal issue that we all have to join in to correct. Good deeds and doing the right things by all in society will far outweigh people pontificating with their words or any amount of money can solve. Sports brings people together, and I look forward to the Broncos and the NFL leading that charge.
Coach, what are your goals coming out of this? You know, when you look at how you address this in a locker room as the leader of men, what do you hope to as your goals as you guys try to move forward in sport?
As it relates to the
To the racial injustice that's created, that sparked this protest, and you deal with, you know, a large amount of African Americans and minorities in your own locker room. What are your kind of common goals as you try to move forward in a sporting sense, in a locker room?
Well, I'm fortunate, as we all are in sports, particularly at the highest level, that our locker room, our teams have no boundaries, and we have players, coaches, people that work for the team from all different ethnicities, from all different walks of life, from all different backgrounds, nationalities, religious beliefs. And over the years, all of those have been blended in together seamlessly most of the time. And I think sports is a great form for that. And luckily, and it just proves how people can get along, because I've been in the NFL or in pro football since 1984. And I never have been around a problem in that regards. And it's because we all come together with common goals, and we all learn about each other. We spend a lot of time with each other, and we move forward. You know, we don't have the same amount of problems that maybe society as a whole has in our atmosphere.
Hey, Vic, you've obviously been in the league a really long time, and social justice issues and NFL players becoming activists kind of came to the forefront in 2016. So how have you seen the league evolve and change during that time and during your time in the league?
Oh, I don't know that it's changed a whole lot, to be honest with you. I haven't seen a great change other than I just don't think there's been a tremendous change, and I don't say that to be negative. I think our problems in the NFL along those lines are minimal. We're a league of meritocracy. you earn what you get what you earn. I don't see racism at all in the NFL. I don't see discrimination in the NFL. You know, we live in a great atmosphere. Like I alluded to earlier, we're lucky. We all live together, joined as one for one common goal, and we all intermingle and mix tremendously. You know, if society reflected an NFL team, we'd all be great.
Wake the hell up. Wake the hell up. We don't see any of that here. I don't see any racism in the end. You live in the world. Your job is to coach a football team. That's just your job. The NFL isn't its own damn planet. It's not an ecosystem independent of everything else. Talk to your players. This is a guy who's like, well, I don't know. I see black guys around. I don't see cops in here beating people's heads into my locker room. Come on. That's awful. That is awful from an NFL head coach. And before we do anything else, here's 46 seconds of Broncos safety Kareem Jackson.
I was just telling someone earlier a story about this is back when I played in Houston and getting pulled over. And this, you know, once they walk up to the car and they see me, they instantly ask, whose car is this? And mm-hmm. it's like, and for me, it's an insult because, you know, just right off the bat, how, like, what makes you ask me that question? You know, I can't afford this type of car. And granted, you don't, I mean, obviously don't know who I am, but because I'm an African-American driving a nice car, you know, what makes you think I can't afford this car? So, I mean, I think that's the biggest issue. I mean, that's the obvious issue. You know, once we take the uniform off, we're just like any other African-American, you know, in the streets, in the community. It could be any of us in that situation.
That's one of Vic Fangio's players who he clearly hasn't talked to.
I don't see any here. We don't have any racism in the NFL.
Well, what about when they get in their car and go home? And they live in the community. These are people who have jobs. Their job happens to be playing NFL football. But that is just, that's infuriating stuff from Vic Fangio, who just doesn't want to know any better. He hasn't talked to his players. He can talk to maybe two of the guys on his very, very, very white coaching staff with all three of his white coordinators. I want to say defensive backs coach, running backs coach, and a strength and conditioning guy are the only faces of color on his staff. But man, if you, this is what this is all about. That's all anybody's saying is wake up, listen to people, see the world as it really is. Understand what people have been going through. You know why I can say that? Because I was right there where Vic was. I grew up in a bubble. I went to college in a bubble. And it wasn't until after that, when I lived for 3 years in Rockford, and I got a real awakening about racial discrimination and a real awakening about how things happen and how people are treated by police. You talk about segregated cities. You talk about racist cities. You talk about a place where actual racist school policy got them slapped down, punished by the federal government because of discriminatory educational practices. And I woke the hell up living there and seeing that, hearing that. And what happened to me was, as a PR director of a pro basketball team of almost all black players, when they would come to me and say, I got pulled over last night. Somebody needs to know about this. I was in front of my apartment and I got pulled over. You know how often that happened in Rockford to our players? Same thing. Driving too nice a car. Sir, what are you doing in this neighborhood? Got any drugs on you? Driving while black all the time. And I was gobsmacked by it. I didn't know this went on until it went on every year with our players all the time. And you ask about it and you learn about it. And I don't know who he sits next to on these long flights and bus rides everywhere they go, but maybe ask Vic. That's what this is about. Don't be Vic Fangio. Don't be Vic Fangio. You know, given every opportunity there to say, I'm going to use this as a time to educate myself, to ask people questions about their lives and how their lives have been affected. I'm going to ask them. And wasn't he with the 49ers when Colin Kaepernick was there? I mean, this is just the obtuseness of some of this stuff. That's just completely obtuse and unaware. Willfully so. I don't see it. I don't know. Not in the NFL. That's what I talked about yesterday when Jason Benetti was on. It was sort of the fallacy of this World War II movie kind of idea. Well, this platoon, look, we got the Jewish guy and the Italian guy and the black guy. And well, we're all fighting for the good old US of A. And you know what? Unless you have the conversations, just actually, that's tokenism. That's just representative tokenism. And having to say, well, I got black players in my locker room, therefore there can't be racism. It's a meritocracy. Just ask some questions. Just talk to some of these people. Find out about them and their lives and what they go through. Because that's just unfortunate. That's too bad. I don't think he's actively a bad guy, but just the ignorance there. The almost proud ignorance. I don't see it. It's not the NFL. The NFL's just a job. It's just a job. It's not some utopian place. But again, I don't know, you coach 40 years or whatever it is, you start thinking that that's literally the world because you don't try to see outside of it. Oh, and by the way, MLB has just put out a statement. And remember what we were talking about yesterday? There's a rubric for some of these statements. You want to hear bad statement? Cubs statement was bad too. Astros statement, bad. Well, MLB, they missed on this one. I'm going to read you two statements here. I'm going to read you bad statement, and I'm going to read you good statement, okay? This is MLB. We offer our condolences to the families of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and all the families that have lost loved ones due to senseless killing and injustice. Whoop, just lost them. Just misplaced them. Ooh, where'd they go? I don't know. Lost. To be clear, our game has zero tolerance for racism and racial injustice. The reality that the black community lives in fear and anxiety over racial discrimination, prejudice, or violence is unacceptable. Addressing this issue requires action, both within our sport and society. MLB is committed to engaging our communities to invoke change. We will take the necessary time, effort, and collaboration to address symptoms of systemic racism, prejudice, and injustice, but we'll be equally as focused on the root of the problem. That is MLB engaging in just the kind of euphemism that we warned you against when this first started. That is the watering down and refusal to confront what is actually happening and what you're going to do about it. That is exactly the kind of way to not do it. There are good statements and there are bad statements. There are ways to do it. There are ways not to do it. And Ben and Jerry's company did the best job. And you say, well, okay, Bernstein, if that's not how you want to do it, how are you supposed to do it? You want to hear how it's done? Ben and Jerry's wrote this. All of us at Ben and Jerry's are outraged about the murder of another black person by Minneapolis police officers last week and the continued violent response by police against protesters. We have to speak out. We have to stand together with the victims of murder, marginalization, and repression because of their skin color, and with those who seek justice through protest across our country. We have to say his name, George Floyd. George Floyd was a son, a brother, a father, and friend. The police officer who put his knee on George Floyd's neck and the police officers who stood by and watched didn't just murder George Floyd, they stole him. They stole him from his family and his friends, his church and his community, and from his own future. The murder of George Floyd was the result of inhumane police brutality that is perpetuated by a culture of white supremacy. What happened to George Floyd was not the result of a bad apple. It was the predictable consequence of a racist and prejudiced system and culture that has treated black bodies as the enemy from the beginning. What happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis is the fruit born of toxic seeds planted on the shores of our country in Jamestown in 1619 when the first enslaved men and women arrived on this continent. Floyd is the latest in a long list of names that stretches back to that time and that shore. Some of those names we know. Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, Oscar Grant, Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Emmett Till, Martin Luther King Jr., most we don't. The officers who murdered George Floyd, who stole him from those who loved him, must be brought to justice. And at the same time, we must embark on the more complicated work of delivering justice for all the victims of state-sponsored violence and racism. 4 years ago, we publicly stated our support for the Black Lives Matter movement. Today, we want to be even more clear about the urgent need to take concrete steps to dismantle white supremacy in all its forms.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.